Delighted to be joined by pollster and political analyst Dahlia Scheinlin. Dahlia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
Thank you. And really, you know, we are trying to digest all these latest results from the Israeli election. It's very good to do this like a couple of days in. I realise that you, like a lot of others, are probably exhausted after a long week, but it really gives us an opportunity to try and look at actually what we think has really happened now we've got all the figures. So, you know, we've got this situation, no overall majority, 58 for the right-wing bloc, 55 for the kind of left of centre bloc with Israel Britannia in the middle. But what do you think the story was of the night in terms of how Likud were able to claw back that kind of 200,000 plus voters to get them to 36 seats and to get them to the largest party? What's your analysis at this stage of like how they did that?
Well, I'm going to be a little cautious about saying that we have all the information. We definitely have all the results. Yeah. And we have the full table showing exactly what the breakdown was in every single ballot station. But there are 11,000 ballot stations in Israel, and going through each one of them systematically takes time. Some of them have been calculated and collated into regional areas. And that helps, because what we are seeing is that there was certainly a rise in turnout in some of the stronger Likud areas. And as I have to say that given the combination of polls in the final week showing a rise for Likud, where Likud had been running about two seats behind blue and white on average the entire election phase, but that started to change in the last week, combined with what I see as a rise in turnout from September to the March vote in some Likud stronghold areas, I'm left to conclude that it has a lot to do with turnout and not so much to do with any particular Likud message or activity during the campaign, other than the very late stage of Netanyahu's aggressive field-based get-out-the-vote campaign. He personally packed his schedule morning to night with visits himself to every, you know, possible pocket of Likud voters. He reached out to, you know, the tiniest little communities and people and sectors in Israeli society. And went around and really invested in those stronghold areas to say, you know, just go out and vote, even if you're not even, I imagine him communicating, even if you're not normally a voter, because turnout is generally high in Israel. It was 69% last time. And among the Jewish vote, it was probably about 75%, given that the Arab turnout in the last election was just barely 60%. So from high turnout, he had to get it even higher. And it was after that campaign, or during the peak of his, you know, very present field campaign, that we saw the poll numbers started to change, and then a final push that put Likud three seats ahead of blue and white with 36 to 33. The contrast is that going to the White House, standing shoulder to shoulder with U.S. President Trump and releasing the Trump plan and basically showing that he's got, you know, a bestie in the White House, didn't move the poll numbers at all, nor did going to Uganda, nor did opening talks with Sudan, and nor did going to Russia to bring Naamah Issassel home from the prison, you know, where she was being held.
Yeah.
And lots of other things that Netanyahu tried to do to steal headlines, and, you know, none of those policy-related issues moved the polls throughout the entire time. So I have to put my money on turnout.
Yeah, so that's what did it in the end. So it was. Do you think it was a case of there were a lot of people that sort of stayed home back in September, but this time because of that very intense turnout, get out the vote campaign, it just got them out. It's as simple as that. It sort of seems to be what you're saying.
I think it's almost as simple as that. I never really bought the idea that all these people were apathetic and stayed home relative to any other election. You know, in every democratic country, there's a percentage who don't vote. And as I said, you know, if you calculate roughly 75%, which is an estimate of the Jewish vote, in other words, when we're looking at Likud voters mostly, that's very high for any Western democratic country. It's hard to get much higher than that. There are some countries that surpass it, but, you know, the general wisdom among people like me who do polling and campaign work and political scientists is that when your turnout is that high, anybody who isn't voting is probably out of the country or just, you know, are habitual non-voters, people who are sort of alienated from the political process. And it's hard to get those people out to vote in any case. So I think that, you know, Netanyahu certainly made the effort to get as many as he could out, but I'm still not convinced that there was a concerted effort at apathy, if I may say so, in September that, you know, lowered their vote. I think in September, you know, there may be, maybe there were some people who particularly sat out the vote because they weren't sure what to do, But those people may have sat it out ideologically, and I have a hard time imagining that they went back to Likud. I do think this is much more about him just getting people out rather than convincing people that Likud is best. The kind of people who were generally Likud voters and may have just not been in the habit of voting much.
And but Blue and White couldn't really pull off something similar. I mean, they did actually increase their vote. I mean, the interesting story about Blue and White is that, you know, it looks like they got 60,000 plus more votes, 1.217 million, which is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've been increasing all the time, but it just wasn't enough.
Yeah, it's not enough. I mean, you know, there's lots of analysis of what to make of Blue and White's fortunes. You know, you could look at it in one sense, like they're in tremendous success. You know, they've never actually served in government as a party. Some of their leaders have absolutely no political experience, including their top leader, and Gabi Ashkenazi, one of the four key members of the cockpit. And nevertheless, they got over a million votes each time, 35 seats and 33 seats and 33 seats again. You could look at that as a stunning success. On the other hand, they did not convince enough people to change sides from the bloc to give them sufficient votes to either win a majority of parties that would support them in a coalition or come in as the first biggest party. So it depends on whichever angle you want to take, you have to analyze why that happened. I'm very good at analyzing why they didn't do well enough, personally. Mm. So would you like to hear that analysis?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
I think that the wisdom of their strategic logic was that they must target moderate right-wingers, Likud voters, or any other moderate right-wingers who would possibly change their mind. And it was a very accurate strategic diagnosis or analysis of the targeting of the campaign. It made sense. You need people to switch block sizes. And that would have, you know, should have helped put them in a position to win the election in the sense of forming government. And so they appealed to that moderate right in the ways that they thought might win them over. But that's where I think that they made big strategic mistakes. I think that you can never appeal to right wingers to move to a party that is perceived as, you know, crossing lines to the other side of the block by portraying yourself as doing better at the issues that the right wing owns. And the right wing owns security. So I think in April, despite their very good showing, it was primarily from within the center and left wing bloc, and they didn't bring right wingers efficiently because they made this big effort to show how badass Benny Gantz was, if you don't mind my saying that, by having killed a lot of terrorists. Well, you just can't compete with Netanyahu on security. And then in the current election, they competed with Netanyahu again by trying to out-annex him, or at least match his annexation, which is probably more accurate. You know, the idea that if Bibi announces he's for the Trump plan and he's going to prepare to annex right away, we can say that too, and we'll annex the Jordan Valley too. And even in our platform, we talk about strengthening the bloc and maintaining Israel's presence in the Jordan Valley. That just looks like you're competing on the issues that Netanyahu owns. Instead of building either a coherent ideology that could compete with the right-wing ideology, which is pretty clear to people, or at least staking out some very specific policy positions on major social issues. And I think, you know, the one that they more or less conveyed in the September election was separation of religion and state. We heard about a liberal government, which basically is another way of saying separation of religion and state. This time, we barely even heard that. And what we certainly didn't hear, which I think was a big failing on their part, was anything about commitment to protecting and, you know, resurrecting trust and belief in the role and the importance of Israel's judiciary, which has been, you know, under assault from Netanyahu and many other figures in Netanyahu's government and other right-wing leaders. And nobody was, from the opposition bloc, was upholding their end of the bargain. Nobody was taking this on. They kind of abandoned
it's an extraordinary field. It's an extraordinary abandonment, though. I mean, surely that's an open goal. That's an easy win. So it's extraordinary that they didn't make more of that. I mean, how do you understand that omission?
Bad campaign strategist. Right. Sorry, I'm joking because I don't really want to blame my colleagues. I don't know who their campaign strategists were. But I think that having discussed this with many people in the political system, there's a general attitude that it's not sexy enough. It's not interesting enough. It's not populist enough. It's not easy enough to explain. I think that underestimates the voters. I think that is belittling to moderate right-wing voters who may truly be hardline on security, very deeply committed to the Jewish identity issues, but also strictly committed to the rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, the role of the Supreme Court, place their trust in, you know, the professional levels of the police and the state prosecutor and the attorney general, and think that Netanyahu crossed lines and that made them uncomfortable. Yeah. And who are the them? Well, we're talking about moderate right-wingers, or at least a significant portion of moderate right-wingers, based on public surveys that have tested these kinds of issues. And moderate right-wingers are, you know, at a very broad estimate, about a quarter of the electorate. And so I think it's an extraordinary miss. I don't know how to explain it on behalf of the people inside Blue and White. The leaders of Blue and White involve three generals and security experts and one career media and politician. Maybe they just haven't thought about the issue deeply enough.
Yeah, indeed.
Outside their realm of expertise.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Talking about some of the other stories of the night, and just so you know, in terms of transparency, we should say that you were doing polling for the joint list, but that was one of the big successes. I mean, if we look at the massive increase from the April 2019 election, where the parties that made up what is now the joint list got something like 336,000 plus, and now 577,000. That's more than 200,000 voters. Mm-hmm. Is that just about turnout and the fact that literally there's just room to improve on the Arab community turnout?
It's not just about turnout. Certainly turnout is a big part of it, because turnout rose from roughly 60% in the September election to about 65%, or just a few decimal points below 65% this time. So 5% turnout is, you know, very important and certainly made the massive contribution. But beyond that, what we also saw is a rise to about 87% who voted for the joint list, as opposed to just in the low 80% range who voted for the joint list last time, which is also good for the joint list. But, you know, basically more and more Arabs not only voted, but voted for the joint list as opposed to spreading their vote among other parties. I don't really want to take a normative position on that, because I think it's legitimate for anybody to vote for anybody. I mean, if an Arab citizen decides to vote for Blue and White, that's absolutely within his or her right. But it certainly is a success from the perspective of the joint list that they earn the trust of the Arab voters in general to get them to turn out more, and also, you know, came to be seen as the true representative of the community at a time when this is, you know, 20% minority of the population who has been experiencing, you know, various forms of political and social assault and even legislative assault over the last 10 years. And specifically, Netanyahu has really accelerated the pace of attacks on the Arab community at every stage of the last three elections. Not to mention that he began these kinds of open attacks in 2015. And so, you know, the community very much feels the need for their representatives to stand up for their rights. I will specify that my work was specifically on the Hebrew language campaign, so targeted at Jews. But we all agreed within the party that there was very much a mutual influence between the Jewish and the Arab communities, who are target groups of joint list anyway, and that they influence each other. And we were not running radically different messages in this campaign. It was all about Jewish-Arab partnership. That's what we found is really bringing people together, and a sense of hope, you know, the sense that there is a different path for Israeli society. It doesn't have to be like this. People can stand together and reject this kind of racism. And that also led to rising numbers among the Jewish population who voted for the joint list. I don't want to overstate the case. Most estimates have this at less than one seat, but not too far off. However, you know, the closest accounts we've been able to do up until this point show a definite rise relative to previous years, certainly relative to the last election, when we have, you know, very recent data and very stable ballot level population breakdowns to compare. We see that rise. And so it's, again, the absolute numbers are quite small. We're talking about, the left of the Jewish population. The left is already small. And the further left, mainly former Meretz voters and people who didn't feel motivated to vote for Meretz Labor Gesher, the amalgam of three different parties. But their numbers certainly rose in the ballot stations that are predominantly Jewish communities. So that's also, I think, an indication among the left that they really felt the need to be part of, you know, a political organization, a political, you know, a party that stands against what the prime minister is doing, what the right wing has been doing and saying about the Arab community and minorities in general, and express a sense of solidarity and rejection of that past.
Yeah, I mean, because it's extraordinary when you look at the numbers for Labour Geshe Emir, it's like how that result is not the sum of its parts from previous elections. There's a lot of voters that have left that ticket. But you seem to be saying
true.
That certainly not all of them have gone to the joint list. They're in other places or maybe just stayed at home.
No, the majority of them did not go to the joint list, of course.
Yeah.
It's still sort of a very forward thinking. I don't want to say it's very radical, but it's still, an unusual choice numerically in any case. But I will say this. It's very normal in Israeli politics that two separate parties who held X number of seats separately, when they merge, they often do a little bit worse.
Yes.
There have been exceptions, but we're used to seeing this pattern. So in some ways, that's just a bizarre characteristic of the Israeli system. And so it's not unique to them. Having said that, this particular merger of the three parties definitely alienated a lot of people, and partly because in the Israeli understanding of ideology, they were really different ideologically, especially Orly Levy, who came from a far right nationalist party, even though it was a secular party, which is Israel Biteinu, Avigdor Lieberman's party. She supported the nation state law, which many people view as an absolute watershed in a bad way for Israeli democracy, and couldn't imagine voting for a party where she was one of the leaders. Although I think what's really important to understand is that they tried to create a partnership of leadership within this small party that was committed primarily to social and economic issues, social welfare issues, education and health, salaries, cost of living, the kinds of things Israelis say they care about but rarely vote on. And to that, on that extent, even beyond the ideological problem, what we see yet again is that Israelis just aren't able to rally behind a party that puts those daily life, bread and butter issues at the forefront of their agenda. They often or always go back to the parties that take a significant stance on the issues that define left and right in Israel, which is attitudes towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Jewish-Arab issues, Jewish identity issues, nationalist issues, and that's really what hovers over all of the left-right breakdowns in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, just a final question about the results themselves. I mean, there were a few other little stories there in terms of people doing well and not so well. And I wanted to ask, what we can now say about particularly what's happening on the right, because we had the interesting situation where Shas, for instance, which has always been part of the right-wing coalition for some time with the Likud, increased its vote by 100,000 voters, whereas on the other side, you've got sort of parties on the kind of right flank of the Likud, like the Yamina party, actually didn't do particularly well at all. So what does that tell us about the far right, I suppose? And also even Yisrael Beiteinu, that was, responsible for a lot of what's been happening over the last year in terms of the stalemate, also didn't do well, and they lost 50,000 voters. So what do you think it tells us about what's kind of going on the right?
Oh, well, I mean, this is one of my pet interests, because on the bigger long-term level, we can see that despite the fact that young people in Israel have been disproportionately right-wing for about a decade now, which should have fed into a growing right-wing population over the course of that decade, we are not seeing the growth of the right-wing bloc. The right-wing bloc has held pretty stable with one peak, and that peak was in 2015 when they got 67 seats. I mean the ideological right, including Lieberman.
Yeah.
But in April, they got 65. In September, they got 63. And now they got 65 again. There's been no growth. In fact, there's been a decline since 2015. And that's exactly where we were in the beginning, in 2009, in the beginning of the decade, or the end of the last decade. So what's going on there? There's something about the right that seems to have hit a ceiling, despite the fact that they should have a source of growth from young people. And I'm constantly searching to figure out what it is, and I've got my theories, but let's just talk about the specific party results that you mentioned, that didn't do as well as they might have. Well, I mean, yeah, Shas added votes, but then again, overall turnout was up. I don't think we're seeing a surge for Shas. They got one more seat than they got last time. It's not that big a difference. In terms of Yamina, remember that this is a party that went under the threshold in April. Okay, so they managed to cross this time, but they didn't increase their vote share by very much. And the reason is because they have not been able to break out of the image of a sectoral party. They seem, for the Israeli public, to represent the settler community, the national religious community. The national religious community in Israel is only somewhere between 12 to 14%. If they all voted for Naftali Bennett, of course, he would have gotten, you know, 15 or 16 seats. But many of them vote for Likud. There were 17,000 votes that went to Itamar Ben-Gvir, the, you know, Kahanist, far-right,
the Jewish
religious,
power.
Nationalist, messianist, all sorts of things, racist. I mean, and 17,000 votes is a lot. And they were probably all national religious, maybe some ultra-Orthodox. So even the national religious vote scatters somewhat. But the point is, the vast majority of people who voted for Yamina are probably from that community, and not too many others would have supported him. He's remained a sectoral party despite the efforts to try to project a kind of, you know, religious secular party that they worked on a little bit last time, but seem to have been unable to truly embrace or reflect to the voters. Lieberman is similar. He has a core group of about five seats, which is exactly what he got in April, who come mainly from former Soviet immigrants, particularly the older ones who are not as linguistically or culturally integrated into Israel, not so much the young, you know, less among the younger generation. But that's his core, that's his base. And he got three additional seats in September, largely by taking an anti-Netanyahu stance. He remained firmly, you know, planted in the right-wing ideological camp, but said, you know, kind of offered right-wing voters a way to say, we're done with Netanyahu, or we think he's been around too long, but we're still right-wing, so we can vote Lieberman. He'll help get Netanyahu out, but ensure, you know, future right-wing governments, or at least a right positioning if he goes into a centrist government. And those were his additional votes. This time he lost one of those seats. You know, he got seven instead of eight. So again, whatever he gets on top of five, maybe the people who are beyond that base of what, you know, we might consider a sector of Israeli society, but that's only two seats. And so he too has largely been unable to break out of being a sectoral party. And I think that Israeli society doesn't say, I don't think it says great things about Israeli society. It says that Israeli society still, you know, votes for parties not so much based on ideology, but on, you know, a sort of a tribal identity, which is what the president called it at one point. And the one party that really managed to break through that, or two parties, I should say, is the one party that managed to break out of that was Blue and White, because they united all sorts of different people from different backgrounds, primarily for the purpose of getting rid of Netanyahu. And the other party that managed to break out of that, of course, was the Joint List, because they represented a Jewish-Arab partnership that went beyond the identity of each sector.
And so, I mean, with all the stuff that we've talked about in terms of what's going on with the parties going up and down and all of that, we are still kind of back where we were in April 2019. I mean, no one has a 61-seat majority. I mean, that we are, you know, there's been a little bit of fluctuation in terms of the pro-anti-Netanyahu blocks. But, I mean, just, and it's a bit of a sort of, you know, unfair question, but what do you think is going to happen next? I mean, we're just going to have another election, or do you think that there's going to be some kind of movement as we get towards Netanyahu's criminal trial on the 17th of March? Is something going to give? I mean, well, what's your hunch?
Well, it's hard to have a hunch, because every day brings some sort of completely new twist. And I wrote an article recently talking about the ceiling we just discussed for the right wing in Israel, and a colleague wrote to me that maybe it was wishful thinking. Well, I could say that I think it's more likely we will have some form of a government rather than fourth elections, and somebody could easily come back and say, but that's wishful thinking.
Yes.
We might
yes.
have fourth elections. I can't tell you which is more likely. I would say all of the following scenarios are likely. A primarily right-wing government of 58 seats in the pro-Netanyahu bloc and some defectors from the opposition bloc, whether it's a faction that pulls away from one of the existing parties, or even some individuals, or, you know, the Blue and White would split with one faction going in and the other staying out, or even find its way into a unity government on some new plan the president might put forth. All of that doesn't seem very likely, but let's say that's one possibility, that it's a primarily right-wing, or, you know, that Blue and White would split with one faction going in and the other staying out, or even find its way into a unity government on some new plan the president might put forth. All of that doesn't seem very likely, but let's say that's one possibility, that it's a primarily right-wing government led by Netanyahu, with a few, three additional members to top it up to 61, who will be, to some extent, amenable to the kind of government they'll be joining. Another option is a minority government led by Blue and White with Lieberman's party, with Labor and Labor Geshe Meretz, and with the one-time support from the joint list needed to swear that government in, needed to swear a vote of confidence to just elect that government within the Knesset. And that they could have 60, there could be 62 members, a majority, who would support the formation of that minority government, which could then take a little time, maybe a year, maybe 2 years, to decide how it expands the coalition. And maybe by that time, the steadfast pro-Netanyahu right-wing party bloc would start to crack. That's mm-hmm. another option. The least likely option of all is that the 62 seats who basically ran against Netanyahu, the different parties would get together and form a government, because they've all sworn they won't be in the government. Well, at least Lieberman and Blue and White have sworn they won't be in the government with the joint list. So that is certainly the least likely scenario. There are probably a few more, but of course, one of the scenarios is that none of these work out and there will be fourth elections. I still like to think that the fourth election is among the least likely, but it's very hard to place bets on these things.
Yeah, could still happen. Well, Dahlia, thank you so much for joining us and for all your analysis. And I hope we don't have a fourth election, primarily because people like yourselves and others actually maybe will get a chance to rest and do some deeper analysis rather than the campaigning and the polling. But thank you so much for joining
us. Well, you're much kinder. You're much more generous than the BBC interviewer who on live radio said, "We hope that there's a fourth election because we like speaking to you." He had no mercy.
Nice. Absolutely. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm Richard Pater, the director of BICOM in Israel. It's Thursday, the 5th of March, and I'm here talking with Tal Shalev, who is the political correspondent for the popular Israeli news site, Wala News. Tal, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
If we could start and just kind of look back on the campaign. Obviously, today we're going to be discussing and kind of dissecting the election results and the repercussions. But if we could start and look back on the campaign, would you think it's fair to describe this as another referendum on the rule of Netanyahu? And how would you say that? How did this campaign differ from the two campaigns we had last year?
Well, yes, this whole political chaos that we are in the past year is basically a referendum on Netanyahu and continuing the rule of his right-wing, very religious coalition. Netanyahu's goal to begin with back in April, then again in September, and then again now, was to reach a majority of 61 lawmakers under this coalition and continue to serve as prime minister. It was a bit different this time, the campaign, from the two previous ones in several aspects. I think, first of all, this started out as a campaign in which Netanyahu's rivals, Blue and White, actually had the upper hand. Because if we go back to December, it's immediately after Netanyahu is finally indicted. He requests the Knesset for an immunity, and immunity deliberations were supposed to start and be the center point of the Blue and White campaign. But the tipping point of the campaign is one Tuesday at the end of January, when Netanyahu, or the beginning of February, Netanyahu arrives at the White House, presents the deal of the century, and just a few hours later announces that he is withdrawing his immunity request from the Knesset. This did two things. First of all, it basically, Blue and White lost their main peg for the campaign. And for the rest of the campaign, a few weeks, they didn't succeed to get their momentum back. But the other thing that happened is that Netanyahu basically takes over the whole of the agenda with the deal of the century and with his annexation promises. And he basically drags Blue and White into his agenda from the end of January till the end of the campaign. Another difference that we saw from the previous election was that Netanyahu put much more efforts into mobilizing his own voters and much less efforts in trying to convince people from the other side or the unconvinced to move to his side. While we were used to seeing very, very unique and I would say successful digital campaigns in the first and second round, in the third round, Netanyahu puts a lot of effort into meeting the people, going down to rallies, campaigning on the ground, go back to basics, I should say. And this eventually did work for him, and he actually did succeed to, you know, swift some of the center-right votes that were on the other side, to swift them back to his side. But at the end of the day, Netanyahu, A, succeeded to, you know, divert the main focus of the attention from his political problem, from his legal problems, to a totally different agenda. And at the same time, he also waged on a very active smear campaign against Benny Gantz and Gabi Ashkenazi, another senior leader of the Blue and White Party, while basically raising affairs, criminal affairs from the past, and trying to make them equivalent to his own legal problems. While Netanyahu is about to start trial in 2 weeks' time, Benny Gantz and Gabi Ashkenazi are not even suspects, but that effort actually worked on public opinion.
Now, I know that just over a week ago, you interviewed separately, obviously, both Prime Minister Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, the leader of Blue and White. Could you just give our listeners a feel for what both of those meetings were like, how they react and how they kind of are in person, I suppose?
Well, they're very, very different personalities. Netanyahu is considered a mastermind of interviews, right? He knows how to manipulate the media, and he hardly gives interviews unless he's in the final stretch of an election campaign. Now, this time he actually started giving interviews much earlier than he used to, but most of the interviews he gave were to very, very supportive journalists, I should call them, which didn't ask many critical questions. I came to the interview with Netanyahu with one goal, to ask him about some of the messages that he and his campaign were spreading about Benny Gantz and Gabi Ashkenazi, and to ask him if he has any proof for these claims and messages. And eventually he admitted that he didn't. So I found that from my point of view, the interview was worthwhile, but Netanyahu was definitely very, very aggressive towards me. He's very difficult to interview because he knows exactly what he wants to say, and it doesn't really matter what you ask him. Usually, he'll answer what he wants to say. Now, Benny Gantz, I would say, is the complete opposite. He's very non-aggressive. He's much less experienced in manipulating interviews or in pushing his message. And also, Benny Gantz is actually widely known for having even some verbal problems. I have to say that during my interview, Benny Gantz was totally coherent and he didn't stutter with his words even once. But definitely the whole atmosphere is much more positive. Just to say, Netanyahu in the past 10 years, or I would say throughout all of his career, has developed a love-hate relationship with the media, which probably brought him where he is now. While Benny Gantz is not using that tactic, and it's also not a tactic that would work amongst his supporters. So while Netanyahu gains support if he has a fight with me, Benny Gantz doesn't gain support. So I think that's part of the that's part of the explanation to the difference in the dynamics between interviewing both of them.
So now we kind of take stock of where we are. We've got the final results, although we should stress that they're not the official results yet. But by the looks of things, we're at another stalemate. I mean, open up with a big question of kind of how do you see this going from here? Where do we, how does this progress to forming a government?
So I think we're still in the hangover stage because on the night of the elections, the exit polls projected a very different result. It seems like it's not very different, but it's a totally different result because on the election eve, the exit polls projected that Netanyahu had 59 seats, while at the end of the day, he only has 58 seats, which means essentially that he does not have a majority to build a government, and that we're back to exactly the same place we were, in which he doesn't have a majority. Benny Gantz has a majority, but it's a very fragmented majority, which includes both the joint list of Arab MKs and the very right-wing, radical right-wing of Viktor Lieberman. And the notion of these two sides cooperating is quite far-fetched. So at the end of the day, one would say the only real plausible way to establish a government or a coalition that will actually be stable would be a national unity government, just as it was a few months ago. But we're not exactly in the same stage because Avigdor Lieberman, who in round A and round B of the elections kind of played it neutral and said that he doesn't have any preferential who will be the prime minister, Benny Gantz or Bibi Netanyahu. This time, he's totally out against Netanyahu. So it's clear that he's probably going to support Benny Gantz for Benny Gantz's candidacy for prime minister, something that didn't happen in the previous elections. And basically what we are going to what's going to happen now is that there's going to be some kind of war of attrition while Benny Gantz will try to play with his cards and try to see if he can form a very quick government based on the joint Arab list votes and the Israel Beitenu of Avigdor Lieberman votes, do it very quickly and hope that Netanyahu's block or will tear apart and eventually some other parties will join him. Again, we are in a very, very difficult dynamic, though, because since the notion of a fourth election is already on the table, some of the actors will be much more confined and much less inclined to do brave moves. Because if we would imagine, for instance, even Benny Gantz eventually joining Netanyahu's government, the fear of another election and the fact that he could be punished by his base could prevent him doing so. And the other way around, if in any normal world, we would say that maybe Naftali Bennett or any other actor from the right-wing bloc would join Benny Gantz's bloc, but that also won't happen if they know that elections are an option because they won't risk angering their constituents. So at the moment, I think everyone is waiting for the final results, final results. And then at the beginning of next week, I believe that things will start looking a bit clearer. On the table, the most, I would say, practical plan on the table at the moment is a plan that is being promoted by both Lieberman and other elements in the joint list, in the Blue and White Party, in the Labour Meretz Party. This is a plan to legislate a bill that would prevent or would ban a prime minister who's accused with criminal felonies from forming a government. Now, in 2 weeks' time, Netanyahu is supposed to start his trial. How will that play out into the dynamic while we're in the midst of coalition negotiations is too much for me to predict at this point. But it's definitely going to be very, very interesting. And if Netanyahu thought he had a clear victory, then now we know he had a very good achievement. He has a very good, he got a lot of support, but it's still not enough for him to form a government. And thus, he cannot declare victory, but rather he actually probably lost.
I mean, one of the watchwords since in the last couple of days here has been the idea of defections, that you can kind of, it was obviously easier if Netanyahu was on the brink of 60 seats. If it's 58, then he would need at least three defectors from the centre-left camp to switch sides. Do you think kind of behind the scenes, is that remotely realistic?
No, because I think that, as we see many times with Netanyahu, sometimes he rushes to celebrate too early. And Netanyahu, basically not him himself, but two of his closest people were already on election night, already bragging that they have four or five potential defectors on the other side, which led immediately to us journalists trying to, you know, to find and to identify who are these people. And what happened basically that in the past 48 hours, anyone who was a potential candidate, about six MKs from Blue and White and from the Labour Medics Party, came out and said they are not going to defect, they're not going to join Netanyahu. So I think that effort actually backlashed against Netanyahu, and to find three of them, I think it's almost impossible. And I happen to know that also in the Likud, they know that in 58, it's impossible to be to bring defectors. The only thing they might be able to do is to bring a full party, perhaps part of the Labour Medics Party, perhaps part of the Blue and White Party. But it's too early for that. At the moment, Benny Gantz has the upper hand. He will probably get the mandate first from the president, and then he'll have between 28 to 42 days to try and form a government. That's a long time in politics. We'll have to talk again, I guess, by that point, so to continue analyzing where we stand.
Sure. I mean, if we can jump ahead of that process, do you think there's any chance that the President Rivlin would look to break that deadlock and look to a third candidate within the Knesset as a compromise candidate for Prime Minister? From the Likud potentially.
Well, I'm thinking, Richard, that you're jumping way too ahead for me at this point, but potentially, if Benny Gantz does get the mandate, this is the scenario. So let's say Benny Gantz does get the mandate first, and he has 28 to 42 days to form a government. During this time, he will probably oust the Knesset speaker, Yuli Edelstein, who is currently from the Likud, and he will probably try to promote a bill, a law, as I said, that would make it illegal for a prime minister for a candidate who's been accused or indicted with criminal felonies to form a government. Now, if that happens within the 42 days and that law is legislated and that law might have a majority of 62 seats, so it could definitely pass, then basically Netanyahu will not be able to form a government anymore. So if we continue with this imaginary scenario, if Benny Gantz doesn't succeed to form a government and he comes back to the president and he tells him, I haven't formed a government, and then the president has to give the mandate to someone else, but there's a law that says that Netanyahu cannot be this someone anymore, then yes, we might see a last-minute surprise third candidate, maybe from within the Likud, perhaps it'll be Lieberman himself, perhaps that's where he's directing the picture to go. But what we see now is basically there's going to be also a narrative battle between Netanyahu supporters, who will say this will lead to a fourth election, to anyone else who understands that the only one who has something to gain from a fourth election is Netanyahu himself. It's going to be a very, very interesting period in this very interesting year that Israeli politics has been through.
Fantastic. Tal, well, listen, we may well call on you again for your fascinating analysis, but for today, thank you very much indeed. Most appreciated.
You're welcome. My pleasure.